Thank you, George. When George invited me to address you this evening, I was delighted to accept, but my one regret was that he preempted the subject matter. He asked me to give you a basic course in economics and then to do a little speculation on future trends if Ireland were to adopt a land value tax that was significantly sufficient to enable you to do things like cancelling the income tax. Okay, I agreed to do that, but my first instinct was to offer you a talk that I'm going to give to your sister organisation in London on November the 4th. I'm going to cheat just a little bit. I've got half an hour and I'm going to take up 2 minutes to tell you what the subject is of what I'm going to talk about on November the 4th in London, because it offers a context to what I'm going to be describing in terms of basic economics. People think that this is another tax, maybe there are some virtues to it, but so what? And even if it did succeed in smoothing the business cycles, well, that's nice, but then maybe there are other ways of doing that. It's far more profound. What's at stake today, in my view, is what we call European civilization. It's my view that we are now very fast approaching the point where, actually, as with Rome, Athens, the earlier Mesopotamian civilizations, ours is about to be eclipsed. I really do now, and I've studied this so carefully and have been quite unwilling to commit myself in public making this kind of a statement, but I believe that we are now on the verge of going into irreversible decline of the kind that ends civilizations. I can't possibly elaborate on that tonight. I will be doing so to your colleagues in London on November the 4th, but it's as serious as that, as far as I'm concerned. The boom busts that we've had over the last 500 years, I can now tell you, because I've done the homework, I've studied the historical record. We've weathered them for a variety of reasons. We are no longer able to do so. The West European model is not just bankrupt, because it's been bankrupt for a very long time. What's special about the present time is that there is no way to recover from where we're at unless we do something extraordinary. And at the heart of that extraordinary action has to be a change in the tax regime, which is what I'm going to talk about tonight. And so that's why I thought I would preface the remarks so that you didn't go away thinking, well, you know, a few bold strokes on the board and that's interesting, but so what? I would strongly implore those of you who haven't taken the course in economics to do so here at the school, because you can't come to terms with the extraordinary significance of the state of West European, and I do stress that, society, unless you can grasp the economics of it. Economists don't understand the significance of what is now going to be happening, but nor can you unless you have a grasp of, very specifically, the economics of land and rent. So, on that sober note, I'm going to run very quickly through basic economic theory as it relates to land, because that's what George wanted me to do for you. And then I'll switch to a bit more detail in relation to the Irish economy and society. And if I look as though I'm going to go over my time, George, you just yell out, okay?
Take your time.
We're talking about a distribution of income, which this doesn't point, does it?
Yeah, if you... What do I have to press to...
Okay,
the top.
Okay, yeah. So this is a very basic model of the economy. We divide, classically divide income into three categories: the wages of labour, the interest, the interest that is attributable to capital, some people talk in terms of profits, and then there's the rent of land. A very simple model, which the neoclassical economists about 100 years ago decided that they would redefine. They didn't like a special category called rent, so they said, look, this is only a subspecies of capital. We don't want to talk in terms of land. Let's say land is no more than a particular category of capital, and that rent is just a special income that's coming to capital. So for the last 100 years, our economists have just ignored the spatial context of life and the role of land in the economy and the function of rent, which is why periodically the economy gets into such a terrible mess and nobody knows it's happening, that it's going to happen, because they're not looking at that part of the economy. They're looking down here and they think this is what matters. You may want to ask, well, why is it that the neoclassical economists said, let's forget that? Notice the downward slope, and this point, X, is extremely important in the economy. In fact, it's the most important point, is the margin of economic activity. It's more important than what happens here. Here, at the centre of the economy, you can see that the income, which we measure on that axis, is at its highest. You would think that that's where all the action was. In Britain, London, the South East, Canary Wharf, the City of London, that's where A is located, where we derive all the profits, and we think, well, we ought to focus on this area, not here, where the total income out of this particular location at the margin is obviously a lot less than at the centre. But it's here that everything that really matters happens. If anything goes wrong here, the shock waves. There we go. Thank you very much. How do we get back? I can't get back. Sorry. No, one more. The shock waves in the economy all start here. When people can't afford homes, when labour is too expensive to employ, it's all happening at the margin. That's where people capitulate, either as employers, as homeowners. But the margin is almost totally uninteresting to economists today, which is why economics is bewilderingly silent on the events that really matter, things like the business cycle. David Ricardo said, look, if people will locate at the most fertile locations, it's easiest to produce wealth at, let's say, the points where the soil is easiest to work, most fertile, the rents are at their maximum. It's a rational thing to locate at the points where it's easiest to make a living, along the rivers, the estuaries, transportation, fertile soil, plenty of water. And then as populations spread, they end up at the margin. And at the margin, David Ricardo pointed out, this was the point where people would just make a living, covering their labour costs and their capital input. At that point, there isn't any surplus. There's no rent that they can pay for the use of land. It's just there that economic activity stops, or it ought to stop. And at that point, you can't ask of anybody anything other than letting them live, because that's the only point where they just cover their returns for their labour and also the returns on their capital investment. If you ask people to do any more there, like taxing them, something terrible happens. We'll come on to that in a second. So Ricardo, in his book in 1817, said, look, there's this downward sloping curve, soil fertility declines, and so the surplus reduces to the point at the margin. Along comes a Prussian agricultural economist, and he said, look, yes, soil fertility is important, but also you've got to factor in transport costs, for example. The further you are away from the market, the lower the rent of land, because the higher the transport costs. So as you move closer to the centre of the economy, the transportation of goods to the market, the costs drop, meaning you've got more left to be able to pay as rent. So what von Thunen, he was the theorist, was able to demonstrate statistically was the further away the economic activity from the market, the higher the transportation costs, therefore the lower the rents. Very simple, basic economics, but of course explosive at the time, because now we were beginning to get an idea that income wasn't just distributed between land, labour and capital, but that there was a logic to it. At the centre, rents are at their highest because that's where the synergy is at its greatest. Lowest costs, maximum returns. Land values at their highest. And that's the way it should be. But notice that the... we'll move on. So now we come to the tax issue. If we were charging people tax based on the location of their land and its value, look what happens. At the margin, here we go again. I'm sorry, you'll have to get me back again.
That's okay.
At the margin, people wouldn't pay any tax because their land value is zero. And if the charge is on the land's value, they would live tax-free. They would enjoy a standard of living every bit as good as people within the margin, because through the mobility of labour and capital, wages and interest tends to be equalised through cooperation and competition. So people at the margin who aren't producing a surplus are not in some way disabled, except if government were to say, we're going to have a tax regime that actually taxes people's wages. We'll tax, you know, 10%. Think of slicing 10% off the wages of people at the centre. Well, if they passed on those that tax in the form of higher prices, they could afford to carry that tax take because... Oh, here we go again. I'm sorry. We'll go back one. No? Yeah. people within the margin, the intra-marginal locations, they can afford to carry a tax on their incomes because there's all this surplus. They can push up the prices of their products and so cover the tax. But look what happens at the margin. If you try and tax people on their wages, on their consumption, on the investments they want to make in enterprises, you tax them out of business. They can't. There is no surplus out of which to pay the government taxes. Which is why we have a permanent workforce that's unemployed. Why capital is underused. Why land falls into disuse. Because we tax marginal activities where people could work, could earn their living, could enjoy a decent standard of living, if the burden of taxes wasn't actually wiping out their ability to work. If we had the tax based purely on Adam Smith's recommendation, he said, look, people should pay to the state out of the land value a sum that was proportionate to the benefits they get from the state. So that arch free marketeer, Adam Smith, was a land taxer. And if we had built the industrial economy on that basis, we would have seen this outcome. Let's say the tax rate was 50% of the rent of land. People at the margin would pay zero tax. So they could go to work, earn their living, maintain their homes, be a burden on no one, and enjoy a decent standard of life. the closer you get to the centre of the economy, where productivity is at its maximum, you pay more, 50% of the rent. But that's in no way a disincentive to go to work or to invest your savings. You could actually take the whole of the rent as public revenue and not distort the economy. That's one of the laws of economics which even the economists who are hostile to the idea of land rent as a form of public revenue will agree. Yes, they say, you could actually capture the whole of the rent, the economic rent of land, to pay for public services, and that would not distort incentives in the free market. And the reason is that there is no cost of production for land. If you work, if you invest and make a profit, you're not actually losing any of that income. Think about firms that are actually renting their enterprises. What are they doing? They're saying, we can make a profit and we can carry the cost of our employees and pay rent. So that model would serve for a nation. Every enterprise could fund the nation's public goods, the costs of maintaining the community out of the rent of land, and not distort economic activity. That is the level of harmony that would be achieved if we reform the tax system by removing taxes on people's wages, removing taxes on their savings, their profits from their investments, their enterprise, and instead funding the services we all share in common out of the rent of land. But we don't do that. We've had, over the last 500 years, cycles of booms and busts. The earliest that I trace these cycles to here in the UK is, not here in the UK, is back to the 16th century. But those 18-year cycles also preceded that, but I won't go into any detail. Here is some empirical evidence. The USA, 19th century. The theory of 18-year cycles actually originates with an American called Homoid, who studied Chicago land values over the 100 years up to about the 1930s, and he said, you know, very curious. I've tracked the price of land in Chicago for 100 years, and they go up and down in 18-year cycles. And when we look at the whole of the US, and when we take this, these are cycles in... When we look at the price of land or the sales of public land into the private markets, we see this trend of boom and then bust, 18 years. So what we have is a pattern of history that repeats itself like clockwork, except when we have the World War. That then makes events falter for obvious reasons. But the historical record is beyond doubt. In other words, I can say to you, 18 years from now, in your country, and in mine, in fact, globally, in the year 2028, we will be back to where we are today. The peak in house prices will be in 2026. That's in about 16 years from now. I can also say that in 9 years from now, we'll have a mid-cycle boom bust. It will also be a rent-based boom bust. It won't be a land rent boom bust, but it will be one of the other forms of rents. The mid-cycle boom bust of the last cycle was in around the year 2000-2001, and that was the dot-com bubble, you may recall. Well, what was that all about? It was about a rent. What rent? The electromagnetic spectrum rents. That's what they were speculating in. They were buying shares in IT companies, but what they were doing was by default, because the governments failed to collect the rents of the electromagnetic spectrum, the result was that people could attempt to capture some of that through buying shares in dot-com companies. That went down, and that was the mid-cycle. And we'll have one in 9 years from now as well, bearing in mind that that boom-bust that we're going to have in the stock market in 9 years will be on the back of of a Western economy that it will not have recovered from where we are today. So it's going to be a terrible experience, but then we're going to, because of the repetition that we know in history, we're going to have an even bigger one, with house prices peaking in about 16 years from now and then hitting the bottom in 2028. And that is the promise of history, unless we have a world war. We got out of the last depression, and by the way, this is a depression. We got out of the last depression in the 1930s because they decided to have a world war. It's not a desirable way. This is UK. To illustrate the theory that I was giving you, I said that what matters to economists is wages and profits.
Keep us on our toes, but
sorry, that one. The two lower lines show you how house earnings. The blue line is earnings rising steadily, and then building costs is the bottom line. Building costs is a substitute for general costs in the economy. Notice pretty steady rise in line with the growth of the economy. Well, what do the politicians and the economists get really excited about? When a trade union says it wants a bit of an increase in wages, this is terrible. The world is going to come to an end. There's trauma because, one of these lines is going to be disturbed. But that is going back to 1983 in the UK. And would you get terribly excited by those two lower trends, the wages and the returns to capital investment? I don't think so. What's happening to house prices? That's the green line. Notice way above the trend there, we had the bust in 1992, and then this is the trend that preceded the bust that we're in now. House prices. But house prices are misleading, because what you've got is two factors of production, as the classical economists call it. Bricks and mortar, which is all you read about in the newspapers, buy bricks and mortar. That's, the solid thing to build your personal fortune on. Bricks and mortar depreciate. Like a car, when you drive it out of the showroom, instantly its value is going down. And it's the same with bricks and mortar. And if you want to maintain its value, you have to spend. What on earth causes house prices to be the site of spectacular booms and busts? Well, look at what happens to land prices. That's the UK's land prices. And that each peak precedes the crash. And that's what we've got over 500 years. There's a peak in land prices and a crash. But our economists, our historians, are not interested in what's going on here. Their minds are focused on those two low lines. Never mind. Well, folks, there's a disaster. It's unfolding before our eyes. I threw this in to show you that not just in the USA have real wages of many, many people actually gone down, but in the UK that's certainly the case, and lots of parts of Europe. The real living standards of middle class, what the Daily Mail calls the hard-working middle class people, have actually started to deteriorate. Their house prices, the asset values of their homes, have soared. So, of course, we've become dependent on them. It's a narcotic. We're addicted to house prices because the real value of our earnings has started to deteriorate since about the 1970s, a phenomenon that's been widely noticed in the West. The result is, I think that's the end of that one, if you could shut on the other one please. The result is that we are led by politicians and their economic advisors who know simply nothing about what drives the modern economy. And when you tell them what's happening, they simply don't understand. So like in 1997, when Blair was elected, I published a study in a book called The Chaos Makers, And I said, well, of course, house prices will peak in 2007, at the end of 2007, beginning of 2008. And then we will collapse into what I described as a depression. So I wrote to Blair, to Gordon Brown, who was the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, who is the second in the Treasury, who became the Chancellor, to Alistair Campbell, who was the dark guru of media manipulation in Downing Street. I wrote to them all, Peter Mandelson, the architect of New Labour. I said, look, individually, I explain. This is the timetable. You've got 10 years to stop it happening. Here's the data. They took not a blind bit of notice. All we had from Gordon Brown was, we will have no more housing boom busts. He repeated it. That was his mantra. What we have in the Western world is an economics of apartheid. When Mandela was elected as president in 1994, we thought we'd seen the back of apartheid, but that was one variant of it, the racial variant. But ours is a system based on apartheid. Apartheid is the division of people between those who have ultimate control of the one resource that we all need to live on and the rest. It's the principle on which our civilization, that's the modern one, is built. We divide people between the haves and the have-nots. The haves are the ones who control the land and the rental income, which is the most important thing, from those who are excluded. It's a grotesque story, appalling, and frankly, we should be ashamed of being landowners. I'm a landowner. I'm delighted. I'm pretty rich in terms of the value of my home. But the history, which I can't go into, is actually a disgrace. We should be ashamed. But you guys in Ireland have really been at the sharp end of the economics of apartheid, of exclusion of people. Ireland, in terms of the European context, Ireland is at the margin. The centre of the European economy is sort of a triangle from London to Frankfurt to Paris. That's the centre of the European economy. The Mediterranean southern tips of Italy, Spain, and around to Ireland are at the margin. Now, you remember what I said about the margin. There's no reason why anybody should suffer living standards below what is being enjoyed at the centre, providing you have the right kind of tax regime. Well, you didn't have the right kind of tax regime. You had one that we brought over here, that is the English and the Scots brought over here, to exploit the Celtic tribes. And the result was a pattern of land ownership and rental exploitation that bequeathed, in the most dramatic terms, the exclusion of people. You couldn't keep on this island, over the many decades, millions of people who would have been born here, who would have enjoyed decent living standards, except for the fact that, because of the tenure and tax regime, and the way the rent was appropriated, much of it going abroad, you ended up actually having to export your children. Now, how much more of a disgrace can fall on a country than that? If you switched to the land value-based system, you would have a growing economy where you could accommodate all your children. We saw the little blip, the top's fallen out of it, so I can't change the video. Oh no, I'm sorry. We saw a small inflow over the last very few years. It looked like the Celtic tiger had solved the problems. The Celtic tiger was no such thing. It was an inflated pussycat based on vast sums of money coming in from abroad. One of the consequences of not having a rational tax system is urban sprawl. Look at Dublin, the top left-hand corner. The other cities, European cities, all have approximately the same number of inhabitants, but Dublin sprawls. Amsterdam is the middle one in the bottom left. Brussels is the bottom right. Turin to the left. They all have the same population, but because of the land speculation and the inefficiencies built into the system, Dublin sprawls over green acres far more than comparable cities on the continent. If you had a land value-based tax, the pressure would be to pull the people back into the centre, where the costs of infrastructure would therefore be lower, there would be less waste. The synergy for people living together in communities that were healthy, based on the harmonies that come with a form of public finance that was not exploitative, would result in flourishing communities. And that's what you would get if you were able to successfully switch from the exploitative tax regime that we have at present to one where people essentially paid for the services that they received in the locations where they lived. And if they wanted to work smarter or harder, there's no reason to penalize them with taxes on the additional income, because they would be paying their way through the location charges tailored to the land value that they occupied. So we're looking at a society that could retain many more people here. Your population is absurdly small, and that's because you expelled them through the economics of apartheid. You divided people, separated them. We have apartheid in Britain. It's called the class system. They have apartheid in the US. It's a color-coded one. The whites, who are very poor, are known as the white trailer trash, because they live in trailer parks. They can't afford regular homes. The Red Indians, many of them still live on their reservations. Black Americans, they live in what are called the projects, where they survive by dealing in drugs. These are the social housing. So it's a color-coded one. Ours is a class one. South Africa based it on ethnicity, racism. All of that goes. We all become equals under a regime where you're worth what you're able to contribute to the community rather than what one class is able to squeeze out of you. Receipts from the reason why you had such a spectacular boom bust was that you pleaded poverty to Europe's taxpayers. People who worked hard for their money were taxed to send money to Ireland because you were not paying your way. That's the reality of the subsidies, not just the common agricultural ones, but the ones that were designed to help with infrastructure costs and so on. All of that money flooding in, that's a graph that shows the receipts, is capitalized ultimately into land values. And because the shrewd guys knew the money coming in was going to end up in land value, what did they do? And it's stupid. We know the historical record. You buy and sell land. To do that, though, to release the value out of the land, you've got to put up buildings that people think they're going to live in, structures that people think they're going to work in. So developers put up these structures, but they were actually squeezing the European taxpayer. You were milking the rest of Europe. That's simple economics. Well, again, is who's proud about that? But you didn't need that money, because you know Ireland has one of the most best educated populations in the world. You don't need to be living off the taxpayers of Europe. but you were. And the consequence, the price you paid was the boom in house prices, an extraordinary one. For a few years, you thought you were all getting rich, and the politicians persuaded you that this was the Celtic Tiger model, until, predictably, it got bust. But it needn't be so. By shifting the tax structure away from people's wages and onto the rents of land, you would not have the boom and bust. You would have stability, continuous growth based on adding value to your communities, to your economy, and allowing your children to stay at home and enjoy living in the country where they were born, instead of forcing them to go find work elsewhere. The indicator of what was happening, in 1994, land value was a small portion of the total price of a house, but as the money flooded in from Europe, so the portion that was land value increased significantly. There's no mystery. The developers of these ghost estates that you have were not actually building houses for people to live in. They just wanted to extract the land value. And they had to con people into saying, yes, they'll buy the house because they think, gosh, if house prices are going up so fast, I can make some money out of that as well. So it's not just the greedy bankers who are responsible. Their bonuses were only a small part of the problem. The generic problem was the speculation in the one asset, the value of which was going up hell for leather. And the bankers are not stupid any more than the developers are. They could see there was land value there, and they all wanted a slice of the action, like the homeowner. I'm one. I saw my house go up in value enormously, and we could clock it up, and we dreamt about we could retire to Spain, and who knows, we could buy a little yacht when we retired on the proceeds. We all engaged in that activity, even if we didn't actually withdraw some of the equity to spend. I did. I withdrew £100,000 from my house in order to fund the work that I'm doing, that I'm telling you about now. But I could have spent it on skiing trips to the Alps and or buying a second home in Spain. But we could all dream about getting rich. And if we just dreamed about it and did nothing about the consequences, then we were part of the problem. So don't just blame the bankers. We're all part and parcel of it. And of course, the outcome was the death of the Celtic Tiger. You needn't have that. You can smooth out the booms and busts, but there's only one way to do it. There is only one way to do it, and that is to remove the incentive to participate in the land market. We could structure the tax regime so that the land market worked exceedingly efficient as a market where people competed to acquire sites, paying the full value of them, but that revenue should be going into the state coffers to pay for public services so that the government can say, we are no longer going to tax your wages or your savings and your investments. If anyone says to you, but that's fantasy, that's pie in the sky, it's a dream. No, go to Hong Kong. Almost a pure system. All land, virtually 99% of the land in Hong Kong is leasehold. If you want land there, you've got to bid for it at an auction. You pay the commercial price for the land. You then put up your skyscraper. You make an enormously profitable enterprise out of sitting on land you do not own in Hong Kong. Hong Kong is rated by the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. and the Wall Street Journal the number one free, efficient, open, uncorrupted economy in the world, whose per capita incomes are higher than the United States, all on land that no one actually owns, where a huge part of government spending is from the revenues from the land. And the tax rate is really low. So of course that's where to go to set up business and make a profitable enterprise. It's where to go to invest your labour if you want to make some money. Very low or non-existent income taxes, but you pay rent to the state for the public services, which are second to none. Their metro system is world class. Of course it is. It's paid for out of the location values around the stations. And that's what actually Ireland could be. You could build a Hong Kong type economy that's commercially prosperous, but which conserved land instead of sprawling, that would reduce the size of government because you don't need all the wasted infrastructure that results from urban sprawl. And you can keep your children in the island so they could see you growing old. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Instead of having to sit at Skype and looking at your children in New Zealand because they've had to go because they can't get work here. I want to conclude by urging you to read a book, Raymond Crotty, one of your own. It was published 10 years ago. I am afraid that it wasn't till about 6 months ago that I discovered that he'd written this book. Well, this was published after he had died. It's called When Histories Collide. Some of you must know Raymond Crotty. He campaigned against Ireland joining the European Union. He was a staunch land taxer. This is a study of history. Ireland is his case study, but you will really find it interesting because he makes the sorts of analyses that go deep, well below what I've been able to talk about today. I've been, you know, talking about a few bold brush strokes on the board. Here we get down to culture and the way the predator culture, as I call it, our European one that we took to the rest of the world, corrupted other societies, destroyed them. We're living with the consequences. And he analyzes it in a very dispassionate way. There are a few copies left on Amazon if anyone really wants to buy it. Raymond Crotty, When Histories Collide. Mm. Thank you very much indeed.
I could ask Carl to say a few words now if